Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. The topic today is the issues surrounding gas flows through Nord Stream 1, and is the 14th in our series on the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on energy markets. Given how fast events are moving, I should date stamp this recording. We're going to be talking on the afternoon of Monday, July 25th, 2022. With me, I have Jack Sharples, Mike Fullwood and Katya Yefimova, all of whom are research fellows at the Institute, and who are also the joint authors of a recent comment from OIES entitled "The Curious Incident of a Nord Stream Gas Turbine" that was published on our website on July the 20th. Jack, I'd like to start with you, if I may, please, as it's important, I think, to get some context around what has been happening with Nord Stream flows in the run-up to the current situation. So could you give us just a brief history of the flows through the pipeline up to the maintenance period, which started on July the 11th, and put the pipeline in some sort of context in terms of its overall importance for Russian exports?
Well, in terms of the context, if we go back to the full year of 2021, Nord Stream accounted for around 40% of Gazprom's pipeline deliveries to Europe, if we define Europe as excluding Turkey but including the EU plus the UK. Now, more recently, if we go back to the 1st of June, the Nord Stream flows were at their full capacity, which is around 165 million cubic metres per day. But as Gazprom's cutoffs to Ørsted, Gazterra and Shell Energy Europe in Denmark, the Netherlands and Germany respectively took hold, then the flows via Nord Stream fell to around 140 million cubic metres per day, around 85% of the pipeline capacity, by the 12th of June. Now the flows then fell further due to the turbine issues at the Portovaya compressor station, which we will discuss subsequently, to around 67 million cubic metres per day by the 16th of June. So now we're down at around 40% of the Nord Stream capacity, and the flows remained at that level until Nord Stream was taken offline entirely for maintenance on the 11th of July. Now, in terms of the flows elsewhere, again, for context, some of the other Russian pipeline routes to Europe have been closed. There are zero flows directly to Finland, zero flows to Poland via Belarus and Ukraine, zero flows to Romania and Hungary via Ukraine, zero flows to Estonia and Lithuania, leaving only small flows to Latvia, and zero flows to Germany via Belarus and Poland along the Yamal-Europe pipeline. So all that remains, aside from Nord Stream, are the flows to southeastern Europe via Turkish Stream, to Greece, North Macedonia, Serbia and Hungary, and flows to Slovakia via Ukraine for onward transit to Austria, Slovenia and Italy. So with the flows via Ukraine and Turkish Stream at roughly 40 million cubic metres per day each, the Nord Stream flows, even at a reduced rate of 67 million cubic metres per day, were still Gazprom's largest route to the European market.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Jack. A really useful context. Now, Mike, a bit more context, I think, before we get onto the specifics of Nord Stream 1. Could you just give us a brief explanation of how pipelines actually operate and what the importance of the compressors and the turbines are?
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, I'll caveat this. I'm not a pipeline engineer, so but I'll give it a go, basically. Essentially, compressors are used to increase the flow on a pipeline or a pipeline system. On most pipeline systems, compressors actually don't operate all the time. In fact, they're only really needed when you need to, in colder days, when you need to increase flows to meet sort of peak demands. On the UK system, they're not necessarily used that regularly. But the Nord Stream is a pretty unique pipeline in the sense that all the available compressors are pretty much used all the time to get the flows at the maximum levels Jack was talking about in 2021. And that is apart from the maintenance periods, you know, essentially 355 days a year, apart from the odd little downward trend occasionally. So it's pretty unique. Now, in terms of the regulations about onshore pipelines, normally the limit pressures to about 70 or 80 bar, that's 70 atmospheric pressures, because of obviously potential incidents where in populated areas. But offshore pipelines, Nord Stream operate way higher than that, maybe 220 bar, which increases the flow so it can travel the 1,200 kilometres. So that's essentially how they kind of work.
So when we look at Nord Stream 1 then, how many compressors and turbines are there in total and how many were out of action by the time the maintenance period started?
Yeah, there's a bit of uncertainty about this. There's essentially what we do know is there are six large compressor units and two smaller compressor units. And each compressor unit will consist of a compressor, which compresses the gas, and a turbine, which is, provides the drive, the fuel, to sort of compress the gas to make it flow. We've seen one report where it says the six large compressor units have 9 large turbines, and the 2 smaller units have 3 smaller turbines. But that's not necessarily been verified. And I know Gazprom, in their, some of their releases, just refer to sort of 6 large ones and 2 small ones. So it's a little bit uncertain. But in terms of operation, you certainly do not operate them all at the flat out at the same time. You always need to have backup compressors and turbines in case one goes down. And what will happen normally, let's say the 6 large compressors, you may operate 5 and then have one as a backup, and then sort of rotate which one's the backup. So you keep 5 on for maximum flows and have one as backup, and that'll be rotated. But we're not entirely sure exactly how many turbines there are, but we do know it's a turbine that actually went to Canada.
Okay, so you mentioned that. I mean, let's make it clear, I think, for the rest of this podcast, that we're going to be talking about turbines rather than compressors. And you've mentioned that the one that went to Canada, which is the root of the initial problem, at least, and we'll come on to the detail of that in a second. But let's just explore that uniqueness of Nord Stream 1, if we may. Does Gazprom have any other turbines, you know, nearby in its ample pipeline system in Russia that it could use on Nord Stream 1? Or is the situation so unique that you need the Nord Stream 1 turbines for Nord Stream 1 pipeline?
Again, not a pipeline engineer, but Nord Stream 1's kind of unique in the sense it's using Siemens, or actually the Rolls-Royce turbines. Siemens took over the business. And so they were not Russian turbines, whereas the Nord Stream 2 compressor station, which obviously not in use, they are Russian-made turbines, and the Power Siberia 1 are Russian-made turbines. So they don't have replacement Siemens turbines within Russia. However, if you're talking just about a turbine, it may well be possible to use other turbines. I know the Nord Stream 2 ones are sort of the same power size as the Nord Stream 1 ones. So it's not clear whether they could be used, but maybe with a bit of engineering, maybe they would be could be used. But clearly Gazprom's got no incentive to actually do that.
Okay, so look, we've talked a little bit about Canada, and as this is the root of the problem. Katja, I'm going to come to you now. So this one turbine that initially caused the problems back in June was not returned from Canada because of Canadian sanctions against Russia. So could you just give us a brief explanation of what the current sanction situation is in Canada with regard to Russia? And can you just explain a little bit about how the situation was resolved around this turbine being returned?
Yes, sure. So it's important to note straight away that there are no EU sanctions against Gazprom in place so far, but there are Canadian sanctions legislation where Gazprom is on a list of designated persons, and that means there is imposed an asset freeze and dealings prohibition on Gazprom. And basically what it means that it's prohibited to deal in any property of such a designated person and enter into or facilitate all sorts of transactions. So put it simply, that would appear to suggest that it would be impossible under the Canadian sanctions regime to bring the turbines to Canada for repair and maintenance, repairing them in Canada and also taking them out of Canada back to Russia. So that because of that sanctions regime, what happened is effectively the schedule, the repair and maintenance for turbines, the schedule for that repair and maintenance was effectively put on hold because of that. And in order to renew, so to speak, this paused maintenance schedule, what was necessary to do is to grant a waiver to that sanctions regime, which took some time because it took a discussion between German Chancellor Scholz and the Canadian Prime Minister, gas issues at G7 summit, and subsequently the German Vice Chancellor Habeck issued a public call asking effectively Canada to release that turbine. After that, the waiver was granted by the Canadian government in consultation, as reported with the European Commission, with Germany. It also was approved by the United States, but it caused unhappiness on part of Ukraine and Ukrainian diaspora in Canada, which launched legal action against it. But at present, the situation is that the waiver appears to have been granted and the turbine was reported to have left Canada, reached Germany, but as yet it has not reached Russia. But what are also important to stress, of course, that Gazprom was able to cite the whole situation as constraining is its ability to flow gas via Nord Stream. Also important to note that the permit, which is not publicly available, at least this Canadian permit, Canadian waiver, it is revocable. It's time limited for 2 years until the end of 2024, and it covers understood regular maintenance and repair of up to 6 turbines in that period.
Okay, so the turbines on its way back, it's travelling to Russia, but Gazprom has also made great play about needing to see appropriate documentation. There's been a lot of to and froing on that topic. Why is that so critical, and what's the current state of play with the presence or otherwise of documents that Gazprom needs to see?
Okay, so when it was reported that the Canadian government has granted a waiver, those kind of massive sigh of relief on the European gas market, but fast after that, Gazprom issued a statement that it doesn't possess any documents confirming that the exemption has indeed been granted. And it has repeatedly issued, to my account, about 3 separate statements, not daily, but with short periods in between, effectively stating that it has repeatedly requested Siemens to provide this documentation, which effectively would confirm to Gazprom that indeed it is possible to provide repair and maintenance service for those turbines within the existing sanctions regime. Effectively, what Gazprom has done, it basically adopted sort of trust by verify approach. It basically wants to see all the documents confirming that it's all clear for this repair and maintenance schedule to resume, not forgetting that there is a sanctions regime in place. So it wants to be certain, if you like. And finally, I think on Sunday was reported those documents have been received. Finally, they were received, understood 1 day later than the ferry, which was supposed to transport this turbine from Germany to Finland, and then from Finland, the turbine would come on land to where it needs to be fitted. In Russia, it's a close distance, so the turbine missed that ferry, and I understand that effectively, because Gazprom has only just yesterday received those documents, it would not issue a sort of, how do you say, sort of another set of documents for Siemens that Siemens would need in order to send, to transport the turbine to Russia. Sort of that set of documents would be needed from Gazprom to allow the turbine enter into the Russian customs territory, so to speak. So those are 2 separate sets of documents. One's Gazprom is waiting from Siemens, and one Siemens waiting from Gazprom. So now Gazprom has got its set documents from Siemens, but virtually just about a couple of hours of before our podcast is being recorded, it issued a statement that the set of documents that it has received from Siemens does not fully resolve and alleviate Gazprom's raised questions about the possibility of importing and providing this regular repair and maintenance service within the existing sanctions regime. So it's up in the air, if you like. So turbine presumably still in Germany. It would be provided that documents are all in place from both sides. it would be put on the next ferry and be shipped into Russia via Finland. So that seems to be the plan.
Okay, so in the report that you co-authored with Jack and Mike, you mentioned that you thought the turbine might be in place by and operational again by early August at the earliest. So first question, just briefly, do you think that's still a reasonable timescale to be looking at? And secondly, how many other turbines are there that, you know, Gazprom and the Kremlin say need to be repaired? And do we have any sort of idea of the timescales involved there?
Okay, in terms of on when the turbine might actually land in Russia and be fitted into the Petrova compressor station, original expectation was it would arrive into the Russian territory on the 24th of July, and then it would take a couple of days to fit it in. This clearly has now been missed, because that would have been possible had the turbine been on that Saturday ferry. Now it's not impossible. If it's now on what's reported could be the midweek, the week as we speak now, ferry, it could, with luck, be in Russia and sort of just about the time started to be fitted by the end of this week. But again, that seems to be the optimistic scenario. That's provided all documents are sorted. But just to refer you to the statement that Russian President Putin made in Tehran about last week, is that now there are two turbines in operation at the station. They're working to pump gas via Nord Stream to Europe. One is about to be taken off 26, or about, he said, around 26 of July, which is tomorrow, by the way, because it's past regular overhaul maintenance schedule. So it's, and then obviously that the original idea was that turbine, which is about to be taken offline, would be replaced with a turbine coming from Canada. And because it is, so just to again to be back on two turbines operating. If that were to be the case, then we would still see the same flow rate as it is, 67 million cubic meters a day. But if that doesn't happen, it's conceivable if the station will be run on just one turbine, that could come down by half, 30 million cubic meters, as he warned. So that remains a possibility. But I don't think that in any event we would see anything below that realistically. So realistically, as long as there is at least one turbine is working, that sort of volume that you see, you are looking at. But obviously, for a significant increase in flows, we need to have a place is a proper, conveyor belt repair and maintenance for all turbines that would have to be repaired over time over the coming months. And if that is established, and I would think that is established once all these documents saga is sorted. In other words, when Gazprom is sure that it's got this kind of ironclad guarantee that it will be able to repair and maintain, if needed, in Canada, all the rest of the turbines it has and will have to do so, and it will not be impaired in any way by the sanctions regime of any of Western countries.
Okay, perfect, great. So looks like something which could run and run for a bit. Jack, let me come back to you. And if I understand correctly, Nord Stream 1 is now back up and running again. The annual maintenance period ended last Thursday, I think, on the 21st. But President Putin, as Cash has mentioned, has said that flows could go down as low as 30 million cubic meters a day. So what are the flows now the maintenance is over? And what do you think the risk is that they could either be reduced or indeed go back to zero again?
Well, in terms of the post-maintenance flows between the 21st and the 24th of July, so that's yesterday, the most recent data, Nord Stream flows have been 65 to 66 million cubic metres per day. So effectively, we've gone back to where we were pre-maintenance. In terms of what might happen next, clearly the turbine that is being shipped back to Russia will not be installed before the ostensible deadline, let's say, that Putin mentioned of around the 26th of July tomorrow. So I do think there is a significant risk that Gazprom will seek to play by the letter of the law, let's say, and take that last but one turbine offline and bring the flows back down to 30 million cubic meters per day. So if that's the case, then I think we'll see probably a jump in prices in Europe as the market reacts. But hopefully that period will not last too long and that the turbine that's currently being shipped back will be reinstalled. And at a minimum, we'll get back to the present level of about 65 million cubic meters per day. Looking further ahead still, it clearly seems quite unlikely that we're going to get anywhere near back to Nord Stream full capacity.
Okay. So, Mike, back to you now. So the other issue that's been around while all this has been going on is that Gazprom declared force majeure on some of its contracts. Could you explain why and also what impact has this had?
Yeah, thank you, Jim. Again, not a lawyer, but I'll give it a go. I mean, force majeure is a mechanism to relieve Gazprom of certain obligations under the contract. Now, there's a whole chain of companies involved in this. So Gazprom's issued force majeure to its buyers, the European buyers, and we know some receive that. Gazprom will probably receive a force majeure from Nord Stream, which is a separate entity. And Nord Stream, in turn, will receive a force majeure from another Gazprom subsidiary who operate the Portovoy compressor station. Anyway, it's the same force majeure notice. It was issued on July 14th to be effective from June the 14th. Which is when the day the flows started to fall away. That does seem quite a long time to issue a force majeure notice after an event, but that would depend on what the contract terms say. It is conceivable that there could be a 30-day notice period in the contract for a force majeure. That does seem a long time from sort of contracts I've sort of seen. I mean, the event of force majeure, again, will be covered in the contracts. It's likely to be an unavailability of equipment would be the sort of force majeure event, which is a standard sort of clause. It's not really had any impact. I mean, it didn't impact the flows as it came just after the maintenance period ended. So it's not impacted flows. I think it's just formalising the situation that that the flows had reduced and Gazprom had sort of run out of the maintenance periods to actually reduce the flows. In addition to the regular maintenance, you could probably have sort of exceptional maintenance and extraordinary maintenance where you need to do a little bit more maintenance than you previously thought, and that allows you to reduce flows. But as soon as they get below the contracted levels, then you would have to declare a force majeure. Doesn't mean the flows have to go to zero. They can go to 10% below the contracted flows, and that could also cause a force majeure event. So it doesn't mean flows have to go to zero.
Okay. Continuing the theme, and obviously accepting your caveat that you're not a lawyer, but you are indeed a very wise man with multiple decades of experience in the gas industry. So the importance of the force majeure is obviously that it helps to avoid Gazprom paying any penalties for not meeting its contractual volumes. But as I understand it, the force majeure can be challenged by the buyers if they believe it's not justified. So I think indeed one of them, if I'm correct, it's Uniper, has already said it's going to do this. So could you explain what arguments might be relevant in challenging the force majeure or deciding whether Gazprom actually has a justified case?
Yeah, I mean, if they've used the unavailability equipment one, which would be the logical one to use, I mean, act of war is a force majeure event, but then we're not at war with Russia, so that's probably, I doubt they would have used that. And then, so I guess a buyer, if a force majeure event happens, buyers would often normally challenge the force majeure event, even if it's a cast iron force majeure, just to give notice that they want to challenge it. So it's not unusual for the other party to challenge a force majeure. So I guess the challenge could be on the fact that, well, the reason the equipment's unavailable is because you sent it to Canada and didn't deal with it on site. And you can't use the excuse of sanctions preventing you getting it back because, yeah, you started the war by invading Ukraine. That's why we had the sanctions. But that seems a very torturous route to go down. I'm not sure that would actually work. But what Gazprom do have to do is to show what they're doing to rectify the force majeure. You can't just declare force majeure and say, put your hands up and say, oh, sorry, you know, this will carry on forever. You have to show what you're doing to rectify it. And whether Gazprom have shown what they are doing to rectify it. And that is a, you know, using all reasonable endeavours to do so. And they could be, given all this messing around with the paperwork, whether Gazprom are showing all reasonable endeavours to actually rectify the force majeure. So that could be a route they're challenging. But, you know, any buyer doesn't have to say, they can just challenge the force majeure. They don't necessarily have to put reasons in initially. They just want to put on notice we're going to challenge it. So I'd imagine that's sort of what's happened.
Okay. Well, look, we're sort of moving towards the end of the podcast now. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of overall market reaction here. Mike, let's stick with you. Has anything happened in the LNG market, you know, as a consequence of what we have seen about the flows on Nord Stream 1? Have we seen more LNG supplies coming to Europe, for example, in the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks?
Not as best as you can tell. I mean, we don't have the full figures for July yet, but I mean, Europe in the first 6 months through to June, LNG imports were up 53%. That's the wider Europe, including UK and Turkey, about 29 billion cubic metres. In July so far, or estimates for the full month, it looks as though July imports are double what they were last July. And that's just continuing on the what's been happening in the first 6 months of the year. So July levels, similar to June levels, et cetera, et cetera. So nothing much has changed there. Yeah, where's it coming from? Or China's still well down on last year. Not quite as badly down in July as it has been in previous months. India, Pakistan, Bangladesh are down. The Asian countries, Southeast Asia, they're still up a little bit. Yeah, Central South America down, Japan, Korea, Taiwan down. So July's been a bit of a continuation of the first 6 months of the year. So I wouldn't say any more LNG is coming to Europe because of the reduced flows on Nord Stream. What's been happening so far has just really continued on.
Okay, so Jack, let me come to you then. We've talked a little, well, you mentioned gas prices earlier and the impact. Can you just give us a very brief review as we sit here on the 25th of July? What was the impact on gas prices of this whole Nord Stream incident? And has there been any decline following the restart last week?
Well, I would say that the impact of all of this uncertainty over flows has been hugely significant. So if we go back to the 8th of June, the TTF front month daily settlement price, end of day settlement, had fallen to 79 euros per megawatt hour. And that was the lowest since the 22nd of February, which was 48 hours before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, in the weeks that followed the 8th of June, prices rose dramatically and actually hit a peak of 182 euros per megawatt hour on the 13th of July. And that was the highest since the 8th of March. So clearly this, the issue of the compressors and then Nord Stream going offline for maintenance. And at the point that Nord Stream went off for maintenance, the concern that it might not come back on again clearly had a very sort of concerning effect on the market, let's say. Now, since then, prices have cooled somewhat, back to 161 euros per megawatt hour at the close on Friday past, although prices did rebound and push back to around 168 euros per megawatt hour by lunchtime today. Now, the restart of Nord Stream 1 did contribute to a 10 euro per megawatt decline on the 21st of July from 162 to 152 euros per megawatt hour, but that decline was reversed the following day. So it does seem that the uncertainty over these volumes of flows via Nord Stream due to the ongoing compressor issues remains very much of concern.
Okay, so let's talk about the volumetric then implications of all this sort of variation on Nord Stream. What's happened to your favourite topic, storage injection? Where are we with storage levels? Are we on target to get to that 80% level that the EU has really aimed for the 1st of November? And what do you think the impact is if Nord Stream 1 flows do go back to the kind of 30 million cubic metre a day level?
Well, European stocks are currently just under 69 BCM, so that's around 66% of storage capacity. It is notable that net storage injections did continue at a rate of 325 million cubic metres per day during the Nord Stream maintenance period, compared to around 415 million cubic metres per day in July up to the beginning of that maintenance, and around 385 million cubic metres a day since Nord Stream came back online. So, European storage injections were not completely halted by Nord Stream going offline for maintenance, but they did drop somewhat. Now, if Nord Stream does drop to 30 million cubic metres per day and stays at that level, then Europe would clearly have lost around 35 million cubic metres per day compared to the current flows as we see them today. Now, given that we have around 100 days until the storage target date, the 1st of November, if that lost daily volume were all designated for injection into storage, then overall Europe would lose around 3.5 BCM. Now, to put this all into context, in the past 100 days, European stocks have grown from 29 BCM to 69 BCM. To reach the stocks of 83 BCM, so that 80% full target by the 1st of November, we need to add another 14 BCM in the next 100 days. However, I would expect that most of that injection does need to happen before the middle of September, before the temperatures start to cool off and gas demand for heating starts to rise a bit. So, if Nord Stream does remain at a reduced level, it would likely mean that storage injections need to continue through late September and into October, and that would add tension to the market and reduce the likelihood of not only reaching the target, but exceeding that target by the 1st of November. So I wouldn't say that it would cause the European storage situation to completely fail to meet the target, but I do think it would add a period of uncertainty just as we approach the start of winter.
Okay, well, I'm going to come back to you, Jack, in a sec to see where we are on the kind of Sharples optimism-pessimism ranking. But Mike, before I do that, what do we think about the prognosis for the winter? Is this the start of a prolonged legal wrangle? I mean, certainly with the way Katya was talking about it, it sounds like it might be. And what's, you know, is that just going to provide context or pretext, if you like, for a full cutoff of Russian gas? Well, what are your feelings about the upcoming winter?
Yeah, it's obviously a lot of uncertainty. I think the wrangling will go on for a while. But if we, our sort of working assumption was that if the flows came back at the 67, which they appear to have done, and that was sort of maintained for sort of the rest of the year, and yeah, full flows didn't really get back on until early in the new year, then yeah, sort of fingers crossed with a mild winter, no more disruption to LNG supply, which, apart from Freeport, has been very, very strong continuing into July, and no big rebound in China demand, then we could just about squeak through the winter period with storage actually reaching its sort of targets Jack was talking about, just about squeak through. However, that would be on the assumption we had perfect foresight that February and March was going to be mild and April was going to be mild. So you could pretty much empty storage by the end of March or keep it to very, very low levels. If you wanted to keep some reserve in storage, then we could start to see some sort of demand rationing in December or January just to preserve stocks in storage. Cold winter, LNG supply disruption, big rebound in China, and all bets are off. Then we are looking at demand rationing sort of coming into the winter period. I guess that brings us to the EU's cunning plan to a 15% reduction in gas demand across Europe, which kind of lasted all of 24 hours before six countries jumped ship. But maybe that can be the content of another podcast next week when they've finally sorted themselves out in terms of what they might do.
Yeah, we might have to come back to that one, I think, in terms of time. Katya, let me come to you. 30 seconds on whether you see this as a sort of start of a prolonged legal wrangle around these turbines. Just a sort of quick thought on the winter.
I think that, as Mark said, a lot depends on at what rate Nord Stream will maintain at flows. And to me, that really depends the current flow of 67 and potentially incremental increases. Rather than drops, would very much depend on whether European Union, Germany, Canada and all involved will be able to put in place that sanctions-proof regime for maintenance and repair of those turbines. Because my view is that what Gazprom actually demonstrated by this turbine incident is that, to me, it tries actually to safeguard its flows to Europe in the middle term, rather than undermine them, because it effectively wants to have a proper working schedule for repair and maintenance, so that no more turbines would be caught in the sanctions regime, and so it really up to the Western allies to put in place such a regime that would insulate that at that level.
Okay, thank you. And Jack, just back to you then. Where are we on the Jack Sharples pessimism optimism scale at the moment?
Well, whilst Nord Stream was off for maintenance, Europe was injecting around 325 million cubic metres per day, as I said earlier. Now, that means you were adding 1 BCM every 3 days. So to get from where we are today to our 80% full storage target, 83 BCM, we need to add another 14 BCM. At that rate of 1 BCM every 3 days, that gives you 42 days. So my hope is that at a bare minimum, even if we lose flows via Nord Stream and all else gets sort of bracketed out and held as a constant, that by the middle of September, we could hopefully reach our target. And then anything else that we gain after that is sort of a bonus, really, given that the weather will already be turning cooler. But again, if I was to be optimistic, I would hope that we would even potentially hit that target closer to the beginning of September if Nord Stream continues to flow. But if it doesn't, as I say, that optimism will turn to concern as the weather starts to get colder. So I think it's very much taking it a day at a time, really.
Maybe just add something there, Jack. But the LNG needs to continue coming at current rates to achieve that. That's based on current rates of LNG flows to Europe, which may look a bit risky as we head into September, October.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree entirely. And that's why I think that we need to do all of the heavy lifting, really, before the weather starts to turn chilly in mid-September. Even if we compare this to pipeline imports from Norway and Azerbaijan, Mike and I have been saying in recent publications and podcasts that, again, the year-on-year increases need to be made during the third quarter, because by the time we get to the fourth quarter, there's not actually very much headroom for year-on-year increases of either pipeline or LNG imports, given that they were close to full capacity in the fourth quarter of last year.
Okay, well, look, thanks. That's a great place to end on. And obviously, we'll have to keep following these flows and the storage levels through the rest of, through August and early September to see if we do hit those targets on time. But look, Katya, thank you, Jack. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for your input. Your report is on our website, so I would encourage people to go there and get a little bit more detail behind what you've been saying. I'd also just like to mention that although these podcasts on the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war on energy markets have been focused in large part on gas, we have actually recorded a couple of podcasts recently on the impact on oil markets. One was published on July the 20th with Bassam Fatou talking about the impact on global markets, and one is coming out this week on July the 28th to look at the impact on the Indian oil market, and particularly to discuss India's purchases of discounted crude from Russia and what the rationale and the political logic is behind that. That's with our research fellow Mahua Mukherjee. So do look out for that as well. But with that said, please do go and look at for all our research on our website. Thank you very much indeed for listening to this podcast, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.